Hello, everyone. Welcome to the session on the 1929 crash. Hopefully, everyone's in the right room. Introduce myself. So, my name's Jordan. People who don't know me, I'm a member of the Wollongong Branch of Socialist Alternative, and I'm going to be sharing the discussion today. Introducing the topic, we have Grace. Grace is a member of the Canberra Branch of Socialist Alternative, and before that, the Adelaide Branch. She's been to every hellhole around the place, but I joke. And she's going to be introducing this topic to us about the 1929 Depression and its economic and political consequences. Before we get started on that, though, just wanted to obviously, you know, continue to welcome people. Some people, maybe this will be your first session. I think most people were here from the morning. And just wanted to let everyone know that the building's going to be open the whole weekend. In the break after this session, we're going to be having food trucks out where they were before, so people can stay around, have a chat with people about left-wing politics, the sessions you've been to, and then you can come along to our very last session, which I'll talk about a bit more after the talk. So, welcome, Grace.
Thanks, Jordan. I guess a good place to start is just like the point of having this talk, given this happened ages ago. So the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression were just like some of the most profoundly catastrophic things that have ever happened for millions of people around the world. This was just the longest, deepest and most widespread depression of the 20th century. And while the Wall Street crash is the most famous aspect of it, the crisis was much more than that and really quickly became global. And also, it's just an extremely contentious topic. So mainstream economists battle one another to provide an explanation because this is not just something that's of academic interest. Explaining the cause of the Depression is extremely important both for defenders of capitalism and critics of capitalism. And of course, those of us who argue that the system should be totally overthrown. So for Marxists, the crisis was rooted in the foundations of capitalism. Crises like these are part and parcel of the system and one of the reasons why it needs to be totally overthrown. But for defenders of capitalism, its crisis is not inherent to the market. It's something introduced from outside, from human error, unscrupulous practices, bad governmental policy, etc. And for some people who are critical of capitalism but are not for totally getting rid of it, it was perhaps the consequence of the system, but a consequence that could be avoided by appropriate policies. So this is why it's so contested. You know, it's such an extreme crisis that it requires an explanation, and your take on it could either lead you to want to ditch capitalism altogether or to believe that the system can work if it's operated correctly. So I want to give a bit of perspective on what the Great Depression meant. International trade fell by 50%. Banks just collapsed, prices for crops fell by 60%, and as farmers weren't able to make money selling crops at the low prices, the produce was often destroyed, even as people went hungry. There's that really famous Steinbeck quote about it being a crime beyond denunciation, watching as oranges burn, despite there being many hungry people who would eat them. Unemployment in the United States reached 25%, 29% in Australia, and over 30% in some other countries and in some areas of the world, some towns and cities, like in Scotland, there are places where it's over 70%. Dole payments were slashed, and often they were contingent upon participation in work camps. Bank collapses just wiped out the life savings of a whole lot of middle-class people, and millions were thrown into poverty. And the Great Depression was also one of the most destabilising events politically in modern history. It produced upheaval and heroic resistance around the world, as well as misery and gruesome reaction, feeding into the rise of the Nazis and the Franco regime. And it led to a new way of coordinating capitalism, a model for economic recovery that led directly into a war. So the Wall Street crash was seen to mark the break between the Roaring Twenties, which is the time of boom, and the 30s, the decade of depression. So worth noting right out of the gate, for the working class, this was not true. Wages did not rise for workers after 1925. But for the middle and upper classes, you know, the growth of the economy, large increases in their personal wealth, new consumer goods and really cheap credit with which to buy them meant that for them, the 20s was a period of prosperity. There were huge quantities of money splashed around on the stock market, on luxury goods, on really amazing buildings. But this expenditure was reflective of economic problems rather than economic health. there'd already been several recessions, even depressions, long before 1929. And to understand the basics of why this rapid growth gave way so suddenly to the worst and most globalised depression the world had seen at that time, we have to go back to basics about how the capitalist economy works and why ever since its inception it's given rise to periodic crises. So at the centre of Marx's explanation for economic crises is the law of the tendency of the rate of profit to fall. So profit is the aim of the game for capitalism. Importantly, capitalism is a competitive system where capitalists are competing with one another to accumulate the most profits. So capitalists can't just be happy to have made billions of dollars because the capitalists with less profits are eclipsed, destroyed, or taken over by their more competitive rivals. So capitalists are looking for extremely high profits overall, higher profits than their competitors, and in particular, a great return on their investment. So there's no use getting a profit of $1 million if you invested $999,999 to make it. So capitalism is based on that competition between rival producers. Each capitalist is trying to beat their competitor by being more productive. So that means getting more out of their workers for what they pay for them than the competitors. So to get more out of workers, they invest more and more in the means of production. So where with very low mechanisation, it might have taken a worker a day to make some kind of product. In a factory, a large group of workers could churn out hundreds and hundreds of this product in a day. And in a factory with a larger, more high-tech assembly line, it might take the same or fewer number of workers to make thousands and thousands of that same product every day. So competition, therefore, means that the means of production get bigger, they get more technical, and they get more expensive proportional to what capitalists spend on labour. So that's, you know, that's good. They're getting more productive, but there's a problem with that. So for each new capitalist, introducing machinery enables them to increase their rate of profit. But for the whole industry, it depresses the rate of profit. So that seems like a bit of a paradox. That the key to understanding it is that machines don't create new value in and of themselves, and that's the basis of profits. Machines are the embodiment of some old labour, like someone built them. The value in them comes from that past living labour. It's a fixed value. There's only a certain amount of value that it can transfer on. It can't create something new. So as time goes on, the capitalist competition means that the competitors are getting bigger and bigger, more expensive means of production. Capitalists are investing more in the machinery than in the source of their profits, in labour. They have to outlay an even bigger increase in investments to generate the same amount of profit as they were before. So the result is that the rate of return on their investment, that is, you know, the profit generated divided by the investment outlaid, tends to fall. But that's a problem because the rate of profit is the sole determinant as to whether capitalists invest. So when it falls, capitalists are much less inclined to invest money. The result being that there's stagnation. There's no incentive to make new investments in production. That means no new production to use up the products of the previous investments, leading to crises of overproduction. And this is a disaster for the capitalist class as a whole, but one that can't be averted. It is the natural result of each individual capitalist pursuing their own interest. So there's some countervailing factors that mean the rate of profit is not always in free fall. So, for example, bosses can ramp up the rate of worker exploitation, so that can halt or even reverse for a time the tendency of the rate of profit to fall over time. But there's a limit to that. You could only force down wages so much before workers just die or not come to work anymore, meaning that competition compels capitalists. Competition compels capitalists to just invest more and more in the means of production. So that falling rate of profit is key to understanding the lead-up to the Wall Street crash. So from the 1880s to the 1920s, the rate of profit had declined by 40% in the United States. And the ratio of value invested in the means of production versus what was spent on employing the workforce increased by 20%. So during the 20s, the rate of profit in the US wasn't actually falling because there'd been an increase in the rate of exploitation. But the rate of profit was still already too low to generate substantial investment in productive capacity. And so months before the Wall Street crash took place on the 29th of October, the US economy was already beginning to tank. So steel production was down, new orders for machines and tools halved, car production had fallen by a third. So industrial production as a whole at that stage was falling at an annual rate of 20%. So the House of Cards was only kind of held up by non-productive consumption and frenzied attempts by investors to find somewhere good to put their money. So capitalists, you know, spent their money on massive luxury consumptions for themselves, huge real estate projects, and they poured lots of money into the stock market, essentially just gambling. So everything kind of looked fine or looked like boom times on the surface. Fortunes are being made as stock prices and property prices just climb and climb and climb. But that asset price boom did not reflect any real value being produced. The speculative excesses were symptomatic of a deeper problem of profitability. So capitalists also spent more money trying to attract more and more of the existing pool of profit. So this non-productive expenditure meant massive advertising booms, new layers of publicists and managers and marketers, more money on, you know, better kind of ways to convince people to buy your stuff, but not on things that were productive. So the banking system also contributed to that asset boom of the 20s, but the massive expansion of credit for new consumer goods, for stock market speculations and to cover the costs of any large investments in productive assets played a role of generalising the crisis from one industry to the next, from one country to the next. So speculators borrowed to try and cover their losses, and many who were unable to pay back their loans or unable to get loans went bust, imperiling banks and other capitalists. Governments tried to protect their own economies. They put in tariffs and their retaliatory tariffs from other countries, which just exacerbated the crisis. And the Wall Street crash was like a detonator. The crash was caused by the industrial crisis, which led to massive speculation and then reflected back on the crisis and worsened it. As those who lost their money in the crash, they tried to borrow, they couldn't borrow, they went bankrupt, they destroyed other capitalists who'd been relying on their loans being paid back, and it all just spiralled down with industrial decline causing further decline in financial institutions, causing further decline in industry and so on. So capitalist economists, of course, do not agree with that take, because if you accept that, it means accepting that capitalist competition itself causes economic crises. So those in the laissez-faire or neoclassical tradition believe that the market is self-regulating and that crises, if they happen, are brought about by something external to the market, such as like, you know, natural disaster, a crop failure, or like human disasters like world wars, policy blunders, like intervening into the market. You don't want to do that. So these kind of theorists dominated at the time of the Great Depression, but their explanation for the crisis and their response to it just was like a fatal blow to their credibility. They sheeted home responsibility for the crisis to just the speculative excess, and they advised the US government that the crisis would purge the system of this excess. So property prices would crash, whole companies would be forced out of business, farms would close, and millions of workers would be thrown onto the scrap heap. But this would be all necessary for preserving the ground for recovery, as surviving businesses would emerge leaner and meaner, and workers would be forced to accept massive wage cuts. So the treasurer at the time, his name was Mellon, I think, had this really famous quote that's like, liquidate the farmers, liquidate labour, liquidate the banks, like liquidate everything, and everyone will come out of it with a more kind of moral life as like the people who are successful take over from the people who are incompetent. So in addition to like just pissing everyone off, the system did not correct itself. An unemployment rate of 25% persisted, as did the underutilization of productive assets. So the result was that the neoclassical economists were just discredited by the Great Depression. That callousness of their strategy was totally just damning. So President Hoover at the time is like widely shamed for not doing enough to combat the crisis. He loses the election embarrassingly big margin to FDR, reflecting just a major realignment in American politics. And during the 30s, a new school of thought came into vogue, Keynesianism, named after John Maynard Keynes, a Cambridge University economist who made his fortune speculating on the stock market, ironic, and was really influential in British politics. So Keynesians argued that low consumer demand due to low purchasing power was behind the crisis. So the market wasn't going to self-correct. The solution was for the government to spend lots of money on public works, so financed by borrowing, and they used that to stimulate household consumption and private sector business investment. So Keynes and his followers are busy writing their books and their papers over in Britain and in the USA. FDR's New Deal program contained lots of elements that resembled a lot of Keynes's recommendations. So the New Deal, I'll just explain quickly what it was, because there was a session on earlier today, was about expanding existing public work schemes to provide employment, propping up banks that had not yet gone bust, letting the unions have a little bit of room to move because small pay increases might boost spending power, and fixing the low agricultural prices by destroying crops. So, yeah, I won't go into much more detail about that. But the problem for Keynes and the architects of the New Deal was that it actually just factually didn't end the Great Depression. It's the biggest problem with it. So the economy reached rock bottom in 1933. Then it sort of began to stabilise for a few years, but already in 1937 it was on its way back down again and unemployment was going up. The rate of profit had not been restored to the level needed to encourage bosses to invest. And it was only actually American militarisation, starting in 1940 prior to its entry into World War II, that brought the Depression in the United States to an end, not a revival of consumer purchasing power or public work schemes. So war production involved enormous government stimulus, government direction of investment into heavy industry, giving the economy a huge boost. And once the war was over, the US economy actually began to slide again. So the same was true all over the world. It was World War II that revitalised industry was a determining factor in ending the unemployment. So it was the rearmament policies across Europe and they stimulated economies. The struggling businesses were revitalised by generous government contracts and the economic strategy that actually allowed for recovery from the Great Depression was one of state-directed economies and just massive rearmament. So it was actually really fucked up what was necessary to bring capitalism back to health. So capitalists like to generally maintain their freedom from state interference. However, the continuing inability of the system to recover from the crisis led to a pressure towards statification, a shift towards state intervention to ensure that different components of the nation's capital were internationally competitive. So intervening to restructure industry, strategically shifting surplus value around the economy. So this is not ideal, especially for some capitalists. You know, it's a strategy that they can support, though, when they see it as the only way to maintain their international position or to overcome a crisis. So that tendency towards statification meant that economic struggles really quickly took military forms. So in Germany, the Nazis' initial economic plan looked really similar to the New Deal. You know, strong government, high spending on public works, etc., to stimulate the economy. And like the United States, this did not eliminate the pressures that led to the crisis. Unemployment remained high, as did inflation. And the regime increasingly used dictatorial powers to direct capital in ways most useful for an arms drive, pulling the economy out of a slump and into a boom. So capitalism could only recover by creating the conditions for war. Germany and Japan, lacking many resources needed for their industry and constrained by their own domestic markets, increasingly sought to incorporate resources and markets of neighbouring countries into their domestic industries. So its expansionism really took hold. And as these countries began to grab new territories, they were brought into conflict with the existing empires and spheres of influence controlled by Britain, France, Holland, and the United States. So the means by which the ruling classes sought to build their economies created the conditions for a new and even more destructive world war. And it was during the course of that war that the basis for the long post-war boom was laid in the massive destruction of factories and capital investments across Europe and Asia. So there's a few important political lessons in that, one being that capitalism working well actually necessitates horrors. Another is the role of the state. It's a popular idea now, I think, after 40 years of neoliberal privatisations, and also, I think, connected to the impact of Stalinism on people's understanding of what it is to be left-wing, that socialism is state ownership or state control of the economy. And the more things that are state-owned or state-controlled, then the more progressive a society we're in. I think this is false. Though this period, through this whole period, states trampled on the rights of the individual capitalist. They had massive public investment, they had nationalisations, they had interventions into the economy, you name it, to direct capitalism and revive it. And that state ownership direction or control did not erode capitalism or undermine the fundamentals of how it worked. In this case, it was something that capitalists were willing to accept. And the Great Depression had one other effect, dramatic political polarisation and class struggle across the whole world. So the capitalist class, of course, as they do, sought to offload the burden of the crisis onto the shoulders of the working class. Sounds familiar. So they looked for leaders and parties who would be prepared to do whatever it took to smash up the working class, to drive down wages and conditions, and to brutally crush the trade unions. So in some countries, they were joined by the middle classes who had been ruined by the economic crisis and who looked for a strong figure to save them from destruction. So this underpinned the rise of fascism in the 30s, of Hitler, Dollfuss, Franco and Salazar, and the rise of militarised states, as in the case of Japan. And Germany is really famously the worst case. The crisis had impacted very, very deeply, but there'd also been a strong workers' movement, which had gone down to defeat and was politically confused and disorganised. High unemployment fed into the polarisation. The German Nazi Party and also the Communist Party both grew. So German capitalists accepted the need for state intervention to deal with the crisis. They met with Hitler, and though they found it less than ideal, they supported his rise to power. It's worth noting that the German capitalists, and for that matter capitalists internationally, did not find Hitler less than ideal because of the anti-Semitism or the violent repression. A whole lot of them actually loved that stuff. The problem was the lack of flexibility and potential for the state to dictate the economy, but both were prices worth paying for the economic recovery. So that pre-war, economic recovery there was due to extreme state intervention, dictatorship over the economy to compel investments, and massive military spending. In Portugal, Salazar exercised sweeping state powers to direct investment, severely repressed the working class, and poured money into the military to preserve colonial territories of Angola and Mozambique. Germany and also Japan were latecomers on the imperial stage. They had to drive outward militarily. This inevitably led to conflict with existing powers and more extreme militarisation. Ultimate logic of it is the war. And there was no fascist takeover in Australia, the far right did develop in the Depression here on a smaller scale. So the New Guard, which is a semi-secret fascist paramilitary group, was founded in Sydney in 1931. Notable establishment figures here were very sympathetic to fascist regimes abroad. They had their target here in New South Wales state government of Jack Lang. In 1932, the governor actually sacked the Lang government. I think it's already happened, hasn't it? The talk on Australian anti-fascism in the interwar years. Oh, sorry for anyone who's interested in that and didn't go. But there was also, radicalisation on the left. So it was obvious for working class people that capitalism was totally not working. In the United States, the working class were driven back during the height of the Depression, but as unemployment dropped in 1933, they began one of the most militant decades of struggle in American history. So in 1933, the strike rate was double what it had been in 1932, and in 1934, American workers were experiencing some really impressive victories. So there were a variety of socialist organisations and unions which grew quite rapidly. The most sizable beneficiary on the left was the Communist Party, which grew from 7,500 to 82,000 during the Depression and organised impressively in the auto industry as well as leading anti-racist struggles. It's worth flagging, the Communist Party also had some serious political problems which are being explored, I presume, at another session on Saturday on the Popular Front. Trotskyist organisations also grew, though to a lesser extent, but organised some extremely successful struggles, like the Minneapolis Teamsters strike in 1934. And here in Australia too, resistance to the Depression was impressive and had a more advanced starting point than the United States, given Australia's existing union traditions. So bosses had moved very quickly here to ensure that the cost of the Depression would be carried by workers. So in 1928 and 29, there were several serious industrial disputes in the mines, on the wharves and in the timber industry, all of which were prompted by really aggressive moves to cut pay and conditions, and all of which went down to crushing defeats for the workers, especially the miners of New South Wales, who were locked out for 9 months, starved back to work, and one of their number was even shot to death by police while protesting. So the result of these losses was high unemployment and extreme bitterness. And the 1929 elections, this was reflected in what was at that stage the highest ever Labor vote, and it swept the Scullin government to power. So workers had really high expectations, and in classic ALP fashion, the Labor Party dashed their expectations against the rocks. So Prime Minister Scullin argued for investor confidence and restoring profits, and the Labor premiers around the country signed a pledge to cut spending by 20%. So there was an explosion of left-wing sentiment among workers, demanding that they be exempt from paying rent. There were squads of unemployed workers that roamed the streets in various places in Australia, stopping evictions and repossessions by force. The socialisation unit sprang up, attached to Labor Party branches in New South Wales, with the goal of propagandising for the achievement of socialism. And the betrayals of the ALP radicalised a sizeable minority of people in Australia. So the membership and activity of the Communist Party took off among unemployed workers, but also a militant minority of trade union members and activists. The political polarisation, I think you could say, the left side went furthest in France and Spain, where the clash between the working class and the capitalists took the form of revolutionary or near-revolutionary battles. So in France, workers greeted the election of the Popular Front government with a 4 million strong strike. In Spain, the workers' struggle forced the abdication of the monarch in 1931. 5 years later, the workers and peasants rose up together in an insurrection against a fascist coup. So it's a lot there, but to kind of summarise it a bit, the Great Depression was really the most stunning demonstration of the bankruptcy of capitalism. So contrary to every neoclassical fairy tale, the capitalist economy did not deliver the goods for all, could not, and was not self-correcting. Contrary to the Keynesians, it could not be tamed with a bit of tinkering at the edges. Only a Marxist approach can explain the constant tendency of capitalism to throw itself into crises built into its foundation. And today, you know, 10 years after the global financial crisis, the world is a fucking mess. There is not substantial growth outside of China and India, and even there, things are slowing down. Their living standards are lower than pre-GFC levels for two-thirds of households in the OECD. Inequality is stark and it's rising, and the political forces of the right, the extreme right, are ascendant in many places around the world. Their ideas have had a resonance almost everywhere. The geopolitical competition between powers, the decline of existing world powers and the rise of new ones brings a tension and a feeling that we're on the precipice of war. So the crisis in the 30s culminated in the most destructive war in history, the most extreme barbarism. And I think that history helps illustrate the importance in this time of crisis now, for all the differences, building our side in the fight, the urgent need to build a revolutionary left, to revive politics of militancy, protest, solidarity and working class struggle, and the need to both politically and numerically rebuild the unions. We have to do that. We have to build our side because we need organisation to win. We have to win a world that does not have violent crises inbuilt into it. We need a system that is not one of competition between private producers to accumulate profit that causes that tendency to crisis. We have to replace that with a system, the only thing that could prevent these crises, a system where production is organised democratically on the basis of actually meeting the needs of humanity rather than the bank balances of a select few.